This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, November 20th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the death toll in Gaza rises as Israeli airstrikes continue to hit the area. Peace advocates are critical of the U.S. role in the conflict and call for an end to arms transfers. President Obama wraps up a visit to Asia as advocates raise concerns about human rights in Cambodia and a broad trade pact in the region. And we'll take a look at the new leadership in China and what it could mean for the country's neighbors. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. A unilateral ceasefire took effect today in Colombia as members of the country's oldest rebel group met with government representatives. Shannon Young has details.
As part of peace talks with the government, Colombia's FARC rebels implemented a two-month-long unilateral ceasefire at midnight. The two sides are meeting behind closed doors until next Wednesday. The FARC has promised to halt all attacks on military and security forces through January 20th. Colombia's government has stated it will not consider a ceasefire until an agreement is reached. Negotiators from both sides are in Havana this week to discuss agrarian development. The issue of land is at the root of the decades-long armed conflict in Colombia and is the first item on a five-point agenda for the peace talks. It may also be one of the most difficult points on which to reach an agreement. In a press conference last month in Norway, the FARC negotiating team strongly criticized the Colombian government's economic development model with respect to land use, a model government negotiators say is not on the table for discussion. Shannon Young, FSRN.
Two of Argentina's biggest labor unions called a national strike today, demanding an increased minimum wage, higher retirement benefits, lower taxes, and more protection for workers injured on the job. Alicia O'Neill reports from Buenos Aires.
The streets of Buenos Aires are quiet. Banks are closed, no commercial flights are taking off, and since truck drivers are striking, no trash will be picked up, no ATMs will be refilled, and no gas or newspapers will be delivered today. Julio Macera, the press secretary for the Confederation of Argentine Workers, says he and other union members spent the morning blocking 160 freeways, streets, and bridges throughout the country.
We're asking for a minimum wage, retirement payments, and unemployment benefits that allow people to cover the basic cost of living.
Macera considers the strike a success because of widespread participation, though it remains to be seen if the government will give in to the union's demands. If the government refuses to raise minimum wage, Macera says his union will plan another action, such as a protest, in December. Alicia O'Neill, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
Rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo took over a strategic city in North Kivu province today and occupied the airport. The streets of the provincial capital, Goma, were quiet this afternoon as members of the Rwanda-backed M23 movement moved through the city, unchallenged by either government forces or UN troops. Yesterday, widespread panic preceded a mass exodus of the city center and of surrounding camps. UN Radio's Patrick Maigwa reports.
UN aid agencies say the fighting has complicated humanitarian operations as aid workers have also been targeted. The fighting has displaced up to 60,000 people who are living at Kanyaruchinya IDP camp, some 10 kilometers from Goma. Adrian Edwards is from the UN refugee agency UNHCR.
Humanitarian activities are at this moment in many instances suspended because of the security situation. Since the beginning of the year, renewed conflict in these two regions has exacerbated an already dire humanitarian situation and uprooted close to 650,000 people.
The United Nations estimates that there are over 1.6 million internally displaced persons in eastern DR Congo as a result of fighting between the National Army and rebel groups in the region. Patrick Maigwa, United Nations Radio, Geneva.
Security forces unleashed violence on residents in a Kenyan town near the Somali border for the second day in a row. At least one person is dead, nearly 50 others injured. John Bwakali reports.
The army crackdown in Garissa came after three soldiers were shot and killed by unknown gunmen yesterday. But security forces met fierce resistance from local residents. Several businesses were looted and a market burnt down. One local school official says that students were shot while in class. Mohamed Shidier, a local member of parliament, called on government to halt the military operation.
We want our people to be left in peace. We know the issues that are happening in Somalia. We are all concerned. We are not supporting Al-Shabaab. We are citizens of this country. It's like a tribal war. Any Somali is being beaten left, right, and center. We are saying this must stop.
Garissa, a town bordering Somalia, has experienced several Al-Shabaab attacks in recent months. This is the first time the military has been called in, leading to the backlash from several Kenyan-Somali leaders who see the military's involvement as both unconstitutional and an undue use of force. John Bokali, FSRN, Nairobi.
The Canadian province of Nova Scotia added gender identity and expression to the list of grounds on which citizens are legally protected from discrimination today. The move comes on International Transgender Day of Remembrance. Events and vigils are scheduled around the U.S. and around the globe. According to the Trans Murder Monitoring Project, more than 250 people were killed in the past 12 months because of their gender identity or perceived identity. Information on vigils is at transgenderdor.com. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Today, Israeli forces continue to target Gaza with airstrikes. F-16 jets shell densely populated neighborhoods, sending plumes of black smoke into the sky. An FSRN reporter on the ground in the Maghazi area of Gaza City reported ongoing shelling and frightened residents taking cover inside buildings. Palestinian Health Ministry updated the death toll today to at least 112 people, almost half of whom are civilians, and nearly 20 children. According to Haaretz, only 6 of those killed can be confirmed as members of militant groups. Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi indicated that Israel would end airstrikes today, according to the BBC. A Hamas official in Cairo told Reuters that hostilities would end at midnight, but a formal ceasefire has not yet been announced as we go to air. In the West Bank, Palestinians protested in solidarity with Gazans. Israeli soldiers used tear gas, chemical water, and live ammunition to counter stone-throwing youth protesting for the 6th day in a row. 2 civilians were killed in those clashes so far, FSRN's Ghassan Banora reports.
Since Israel's latest military operation began in Gaza 6 days ago, Palestinians in the West Bank have responded with protests around Ramallah City, Central West Bank, Nablus and Tulkarim in the north, as well as Bethlehem and Hebron, Southern West Bank. About 100 mothers and their children held a protest today at the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem City, condemning the Israeli bombardment that has killed at least 18 children since Wednesday. Mira, who said she could not give her last name for fear of reprisal, is a mother of 2.
Our children and women in Gaza are being killed. Today we march in solidarity with Gaza and to send a message that Gaza is not alone.
Two blocks away, at a different protest, Israeli soldiers attacked some 500 university and high school students who were trying to reach the Israeli separation wall, which cuts off Bethlehem from Jerusalem. Soldiers fired tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. At least 30 were injured. Muhammad, who also declined to give his name, was one of the youth protesting near the wall in Bethlehem.
The situation here is very, very dangerous. All of us here go on demonstrations to help other families and brothers and sisters in Gaza. All of us are Palestinian. We are one hand together.
Meanwhile, in Bethlehem, activists are planning sit-ins and prayers in solidarity with Gaza. Abdel Fattah Abusrur is one of the organizers.
With all this violent aggression against Gaza and the bombardment with Israeli missiles all over, we are here with our children to go and show our solidarity with our own people. and say that we are with them. And what is happening in the West Bank is complementary to what is happening in Gaza. We refuse to be silenced, and we refuse to be just simple observers on what is happening.
The area in the West Bank near the separation wall and the checkpoints has been a hotspot for clashes between local youth and invading Israeli troops. Yesterday, two men were killed by Israeli troops. 22-year-old Hamdi Falah was shot in the head by Israeli troops in Hebron City, southern West Bank. Rushdi At-Tamimi, 35, from the village of An-Nabi Saleh near Ramallah, died on Monday from wounds received at a Gaza solidarity protest on Saturday. At-Tamimi and other villagers were protesting when soldiers attacked them with tear gas and live ammunition. Later, clashes erupted between local youth and invading Israeli soldiers. A video released by activists on YouTube showed that after Israeli troops shot At-Tamimi, they surrounded him and did not allow medics to treat him. Doctors say he was hit with two live rounds in his leg and abdomen. At-Tamimi died Monday from severe bleeding. Mohammed At-Tamimi is one of the nonviolent protest organizers in An-Nabi Saleh village.
There are systematic policies against the resistance in Al-Nabi Saleh, and no doubt that the Israeli attacks on Gaza gave the occupation forces new reasons to attack us and stop the protests from spreading. Today we promised our fallen hero that we will continue and we will carry on protesting all over our country.
Near the Israeli wall in Bethlehem City, as night falls, clashes continue, as is the case in many other Palestinian cities. Protesters say they are not going to stop until the attack on Gaza stops. Ghassan Bannoura, Afasaran, Bethlehem.
As more nations and international groups call for diplomacy between Israel and Gaza, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton heads to the region today, hoping to negotiate an end to the week-long violence that has claimed many civilian lives. But Amnesty International and other peace advocates are concerned that ongoing military aid to Israel and recently passed pro-Israel congressional resolutions undermine the negotiating role of the U.S. They're calling for an immediate end to all arms transfers to both Hamas and Israel, and the monitoring and investigation of war crimes committed by both sides. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Secretary Clinton broke off scheduled meetings in Cambodia today to fly to Jerusalem, where she will meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. She has also scheduled talks with Palestinian leaders in the West Bank and Egyptian officials in Cairo, but not with Hamas, which the U.S. considers a terrorist organization. Texas Republican Ted Poe agreed with this designation in a recent speech to the House of Representatives.
The terrorist group Hamas doesn't want peace with Israel, it wants war. Hamas is the aggressor here. It kills Israeli citizens and then hides behind the skirts of Palestinian women. The world should condemn Hamas, not Israel. Israel has the moral right and legal duty to defend itself from the attacks by the barbarians Hamas. The United States should be bold in its total support of Israel, our ally. The U.S. should be bold in its condemnation of Hamas. And the U.S. should be bold in this continuing war by terrorists like Hamas on civilized nations.
Poe urged Congress to pass official resolutions voicing such support. The Senate passed theirs unanimously on Friday, while the House scheduled no debate or vote and only announced Friday that the resolution passed without objection. But some representatives, including Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich, did object. Kucinich called the resolution unnecessarily one-sided and criticized it for not mentioning the mounting civilian deaths in Gaza. Some Jewish American advocates, including Ori Ner with Americans for Peace Now, agreed.
There is a great deal missing from such resolutions in the form of talking about striving for minimizing, curtailing as much as possible, loss of life on both sides of the border, both in Israel and in Gaza, and that surprisingly has been missing from this resolution. And the other thing, which is more important as a matter of principle, I think, is the idea of the broader picture of where we go from here in order to try to achieve peace between Israelis and Palestinians.
Both Americans for Peace Now and their Israeli sister group say the kind of support the U.S. is expressing for Israel's military actions put future peace negotiations at risk. And this goes far beyond diplomatic and political support. The U.S. government supplies Israel with more than $3 billion in military aid every year, most of which is used to buy weapons from U.S. corporations, including the F-16s and missiles currently being used over Gaza. As reporters, children, and other civilians continue to lose their lives, Sunjiv Berry with Amnesty International is calling for a complete arms embargo for all the parties involved.
We are calling on individual nations to immediately suspend the transfer of weapons, ammunition, and military equipment to any of the parties in this conflict. That means specifically that the U.S. government must halt the shipments or transfer of weapons and ammunition to Israel immediately.
Amnesty is also calling for the UN Security Council to dispatch human rights monitors to Gaza and Israel to investigate and document reports of war crimes, including strikes on homes and news media buildings.
The last time there was a conflict, several years ago, of a similar nature, was total impunity in the aftermath. That meant that none of the parties, whether Israel, Hamas, or Palestinian armed groups, had any sort of internal accountability for the crimes that were committed against civilians in the conflict.
As Clinton joins diplomats from Israel, Egypt, Qatar, and Turkey to begin negotiations today, the U.S. delegation to the United Nations blocked the passage of a Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire. A U.S. spokesperson called the draft resolution counterproductive and unacceptable because it did not cite Hamas rockets into Israel as the origin of the current conflict. Alice Holstein, FSRN, Washington.
Join Free Speech Radio News on Friday, November 23rd, for a special program, Rising Tides, Rising Voices, Climate Change and the New Reality.
And those emissions are destroying the planet, and you see it in China, and you see it in El Salvador, and you see it in Peru, and now you see it in New York.
We are beginning to see some opening up in terms of disclosure about what is really going on, about how much resources are being taken, how much is being spent. So there's hope that things will begin to change.
We are all aware that time is ticking and we are quickly running out.
Rising Tides, Rising Voices, Climate Change and the New Reality, a special half-hour program. That's Friday, November 23rd, here on FSRN. Today, leaders of Asian nations gathered in Phnom Penh, Cambodia for a final day of talks on trade, security, and territorial disputes. U.S. President Barack Obama also joined the meeting. He urged more support for a regional trade deal called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. U.S. officials traveling with Obama said Japan had expressed interest in joining talks on the deal. On Sunday, Thailand's prime minister said the country would join negotiations, but the trade deal also drew protesters in Thailand who gathered at the airport. And the extensive trade pact has drawn criticism from watchdog groups who say it could weaken environmental, labor, and consumer protection laws. Arthur Stamulis is director of the Citizens Trade Campaign. He said the deal would undercut safeguards in the Asia region.
The TPP is about setting the rules of the game for trade and investment throughout the Pacific Rim and by extension throughout the world. Unlike many countries, the U.S. agenda is not so much a national agenda as a corporate agenda. It's about handing a smorgasbord of new rights and privileges and powers to corporate interest groups.
Finding out the content of the trade deal has been a challenge, says Stamulis, as much of the negotiations have taken place behind closed doors. But through leaked documents, the watchdog group has found that the proposed deal covers a range of issues, such as access to pharmaceuticals and labor regulations.
What we know comes from a handful of documents that Citizens Trade Campaign were the first to publish, showing that the U.S. is pushing a radical big pharma program of expanding drug patents beyond their current 20 years through the TPP, that they're expanding NAFTA's infamous investor state program throughout the Pacific Rim, which would grant individual corporations the right to challenge virtually any new law, regulation, or even court decision that negatively affects our expectation of profits and challenge them through a process that circumvents domestic judicial systems, primarily through a World Bank tribunal.
According to the documents, oil and energy companies are also pushing for easing restrictions to hydraulic fracturing or fracking in Asia. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative said the agreement would make the regulatory systems of TPP countries, quote, more compatible so U.S. companies can operate more seamlessly. The next talks on the deal, according to the Trade Office, will take place in New Zealand in the first week of December. During President Obama's visit to Cambodia, human rights groups also called on the U.S. to condemn abuses under the leadership of Hun Sen, a former Khmer Rouge leader and current prime minister. According to Human Rights Watch, more than 300 people have been killed in politically motivated attacks in the country since 1991. Ahead of Obama's visit to Cambodia, the advocacy group released a report. Brad Adams is director of the Human Rights Watch's Asia Division. He's also the author of the report, and he spoke to FSRN about the record of Prime Minister Hun Sen.
He has ruled by violence, threats, and intimidation. He has carried out a bloody coup. He has been responsible for orchestrating extrajudicial executions. Cambodia has very serious problem with torture. He manipulates the courts, including in the trials of the former Khmer Rouge, where he's trying to limit the number of people who could be put on trial. And now he's engaging, through proxies, a large-scale effort to move average Cambodians off their land. So his record is deplorable, and he's kind of the forgotten strongman or dictator of the world. He's now one of the 10 longest-serving leaders in the world, and very few people pay attention to him.
When President Obama met with Prime Minister Hun Sen in Cambodia, he reportedly urged him to hold fair elections and release political prisoners. That's according to Ben Rhodes, the deputy national security advisor who's traveling with Obama in the region. Are you satisfied with this action? What more could be done?
I can't tell you how upset we are with President Obama and his team. We spoke to them for months about this, as have others. They needed to not engage in business as usual. Hun Sen has got an earful about human rights for years, but nothing happens. And so we pleaded with the Obama administration for Obama to take 5 minutes out of his presidency while he's in Cambodia and give an interview or give a public talk that could be heard by Cambodians, so that they could hear directly.
Well, President Obama did speak out in Myanmar, in Burma, before he came to Cambodia. He had similar calls on him to at least address human rights violations with the ethnic violence taking place in the Rakhine State. And he did come out and talk about the Rohingya people directly in that, but that wasn't the case in Cambodia.
That's right. I mean, we're very pleased with the speech he gave at Rangoon University in Burma. He addressed all the key issues. In fact, there was some debate about whether he should speak directly about the attacks on the Rohingya, and he did. And we remain mystified why he couldn't have done the same thing in Cambodia. I mean, this is a country with a leader who's been in power for 27 years, who rules ruthlessly. And one would think they would have learned from the Arab Spring that people around the world don't want to live under these kind of people anymore. And the United States should clearly be on the side of the public, not on the side of these leaders.
That's Brad Adams, director of the Asia Division at Human Rights Watch. This week, U.S. President Barack Obama also met with China's premier, Wen Jiabao. Trade and political rights remain issues between the two countries. Last week, President Xi Jinping took the reins of the world's most populous country. China is currently the world's second largest economy and the global manufacturing hub for electronic goods that keeps prices low for international consumers. For 10 years, its economy grew by 400%, and so have inequality and regional unrest. Some experts estimate that as many as tens of thousands of protests spring up in China each year. Recently, China has been tussling with the U.S. and Canada over trade issues. Last year, the WTO upheld U.S. tariffs on Chinese-made tires, and the Canadian government has been reluctant to allow a Chinese state-owned energy company to take over Canadian petroleum producer Nexen. Many people are watching and waiting to see if China's new leader will uphold the status quo or challenge corruption and politics as usual. FSRN's Danny Wood spoke with Peter Kwong, a professor of Asian American Studies at Hunter College. His article, China's Shaky Leadership Transition, recently ran in The Nation magazine.
In your article in The Nation, you write that the CCP is experiencing unprecedented internal quarrels. In what ways have these quarrels changed over time?
Well, in the Chinese Communist Party, since the reform, you have developed very sharp division within the party. They're the those people who want to focus on economic growth. There are those people who felt that economic growth will sacrifice the ideological purity of the party. And then there are those who are princelings, who are sons and daughters of top leaderships. And these groups are contending among themselves. The problem right now is the Communist Party leadership has been operating in a situation that using their political power to amass personal fortune. People are very, very angry about this.
You mentioned those problems of corruption and amassing wealth, and in his speech, Xi Jinping did list corruption, taking bribes, being out of touch with the people, undue emphasis on formalities and bureaucratism as issues that must be addressed with what he described as great efforts, according to the translation aired on BBC News. What do you see as the most important issue there that he needs to address, and what can he really do about it?
I think every single party member has to talk about corruption because it's so blatant. Everybody can see it. So in order to survive, they do have to talk about it. But they've been talking about it forever, and very little has been done about it. And the reason being is Chinese Communist Party is one party system, that they are their own executive, judicial, legislative, police, and all that kind of stuff. They cannot correct themselves.
In your article, you also write that China's Communist Party is having to deal with a rising nationalism in its people, and you refer to the dispute with Japan over the islands off the Taiwanese coast, and also a mob attack on U.S. Ambassador Gary Locke's car in Beijing in September. You also say this nationalism has a potential to turn people against their leaders. Can you describe what you mean?
Yes. Recent time, the Japanese government has went through a particular administrative measure that caused a great deal of unhappiness, particular anger among the Chinese public. But there were all kinds of demonstrations. And so the demonstration started out as patriotic, pure patriotic activities, slowly turning into criticism. First, criticizing that the Chinese leadership is not forceful enough. And then you see these demonstrations with Chairman Mao's portrait and slogans, and that hits at the heart of this movement. That is to say, we are not confident of the present leadership. The problem with Chinese leadership is, what do you do with this anger? And I think that's a very dangerous situation that's occurring in China today, that the government is forced to take more aggressive nationalist action to appease and divert the anger of the Chinese public.
Peter Kwong, Professor of Asian American Studies at Hunter College, New York. Thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you so much, Jim, for the opportunity to talk about these things.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Puck Lowe and Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.